Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Chapter 12. Greta is in the kitchen sitting in her moose antler chair for the very first time. It's very comfortable and quite throne-like, and she feels herself relaxing in anticipation of the animal wisdom she hopes will come from the chair. She plans to have only the chair, her red raya rug, and a large plant in the new room. And of course, the white drawing table and the cutting table, plus the workbench. She'll have built-in drawers for supplies, but she has to wait until the ground thaws before they can even start on the room. In the meantime, she must be patient, even though she is already psychologically in the new room, facing the lake, absorbing the brightness of fresh snow, meditating through the icicles hanging from the roof, watching the snow blow across the lake. Ice is becoming increasingly important to Greta. Each morning, when she feeds the birds, she breaks off an icicle from somewhere, this morning from the garage where the clearest and longest were reachable. She puts the icicle on a white serving dish in the center of the table where she can enjoy it while she has her toast and tea. Each one is different. Each icicle melts in its own way. She loves the striations of air in the center of an otherwise clear icicle. Some have perfect little bubbly scenes, others the extreme clarity only ice can have, and perhaps glass. She's seen this iciness in glass. She lets the phone ring while she finishes the last piece of toast and honey. She doesn't mind the ringing, and her friends know she doesn't rush, but she is surprised that it's Karloff. He rarely calls. He wants her to stop at Tom's before she comes over to the skate to pick up a gun. Tom's cold is worse, and he's not coming to the sauna tonight. Sure, she'll pick it up, she tells him, though she's puzzled. Doesn't he have a gun? She remembers Karloff last partridge season, standing out near his dock, oiling a gun, or doing something with it as she paddled by. She's sure of it. Yes, it was that last really warm day when she canoed down the lake to sketch lily pads. Maybe it wasn't his gun. Maybe he borrowed it. Seems odd, in any case, since everyone on the lake has a gun. Even she has one, a .22 she keeps locked in the built-in gun case in the back room of the cabin. There's room for five more guns in the case, so she keeps her old ballet slippers locked inside, though she doesn't really know why. Greta plans to spend the morning working on Dorothy's fruit design. She can pick up the gun just before she goes to Karloff's. Last night, she recut some of the leaves to replace the ones she chipped, and the new leaves turned out well, very well. She's using antique green glass with subtly mottled shadings, and it was a stroke of luck how the darkest green had edged the leaves. She bought a considerable supply of antique glass in Thunder Bay at the co-op, left by someone who had given up on the art and moved to Vancouver. Ordinarily, Greta has been intimidated by antique glass, so hasn't given herself much of a chance to work with it, but her cutting has improved considerably in the past week, simply by working with it. Settling down at her work table, she adjusts the light and starts fitting the pieces into place. The oranges and lemons fit like rising moons and suns above the deep purple cluster of grapes. The leaves she cut last night are undoubtedly the best curved work she's ever done, even though the shading was accidental, and now the leaves of the grapevine swirl around the fruit in a casual elegance. The background of this circular work is a cloudy pale blue. Greta tapes the pieces into place with infinite care, losing track of time as she works. This is the most enjoyable part of designing in stained glass, seeing all the pieces together for the first time. Seeing it in glass. Taping takes time and is a labor of love for Greta. The blooming of the garden. She knows this is one of her very best pieces and decides to leave it as it is on the table. Enough for one day. She stretches her arms high above her head, touches her toes and stretches up again, celebrating her good health and the success of the morning's work. She turns up the volume of the music, Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20. Fawn keeps pressing her to get a CD player for the new room. Maybe. She has time to think about it, and if she goes to the glass show in Winnipeg next month, she might look. Just so she doesn't end up like Fawn, who has music on from morning out till night, and you never hear anything else. She always has a great variety of birds at the feeders on her deck, but you can never hear them. Gabriel has been hiding lately. She doesn't know why. She's been sleeping again without having opened the bottle of sleeping pills, and she has little concern about his disappearance. She knows he'll be back in the next snow, if not before. No use making a big deal of it. That was her problem before, she's decided. The icicle is now the size of a small tooth. She pours it into the sink with the ice water and jots down on the calendar how long it took to melt, along with her comment of the day. The longevity of icicles is always surprising. She reads over the week's comments. Monday, all is water, rose-breasted grosbeak. Tuesday, also all may be ice. Skating. Wednesday, my tea is made from the same water the dinosaurs once drank. Thursday, nothing is more beautiful than ice, except to dance. Friday, remember vanilla, almonds, and oats. Circles. She's on her way to Karloff's, and the gun is in the trunk. She gave Tom's wife a loaf of banana bread when she picked up the gun. Ephronsia, an odd name. It's never seemed like a real name to Greta, Ephronsia. Or Fronzi is Ukrainian and speaks only a few words of English. And once in a while, she comes to a sauna evening, but Greta thinks it's only to please Tom. Tom calls her Frozy. Frozy is a large woman, not at all comfortable with her big rosy body. She's an alcoholic who knits in the mornings when she's sober. Fawn buys wool for her in Thunder Bay and has been encouraging her to sell some of her mittens at the co-op. Last summer, Fawn brought her a notice of an AA meeting in Red Otter, but Frozy hid every time Fawn stopped by after that and wouldn't see her at all for 6 weeks. Sometimes Frozy walks down the road to Greta's, gives her a present, a pair of knitted socks or mittens, and once, through much negotiation with Tom, Frozy took a boat ride down the lake with Greta to pick blueberries. They went down the lake to Sad Man Falls one clear summer morning. Frozy took her gray Persian cat along in the boat. She and the cat sat together in the bow of the boat like Queen Nefertiti and her palace cat, sailing on a pleasure cruise down the Nile of life. That's the exact phrase that came to Greta that day, riding down the Nile of life. They picked several quarts of berries while the cat wandered off, but later reappeared nonchalantly at the boat when they were ready to leave. Greta thinks of Gabriel's mother sometimes when she looks at Frozy, though the two look nothing alike. Gabriel's mother was from Leningrad and a woman of high culture, quite unlike Frozy. Sometimes Greta gets angry thinking of Frozy and her drinking, her reclusiveness. Still, she knows getting upset about Frozy is like getting angry with a cat. Yet it's just such a waste, all that drinking, all that loss, even though she doesn't know what might fill its place. She drives past the hazelnut thicket where she saw Frozy picking nuts last fall. She had smiled as Greta drove past, but when Greta came back with a bag and walked off the side of the road to join her, Frozy ran off, cutting through the woods toward her cabin like a scared rabbit. So Greta picked the prickly hazelnuts by herself and spread them in the basement to dry until Christmas. Greta hears barking inside as she knocks on Karloff's door with the gun slung over her shoulder. Karloff shuts the door behind him, comes out to the porch, puts on his boots. He takes the gun from Greta and they start down toward the lake. It's that shadow, you know. I've got him now. Leto's gave him up. The wolves, they come around, so I need the gun. I thought you had a gun, Greta says. It's no good, bent. That ends that, though she can't imagine how a gun would get bent. In the ice house, they go through their skate lacing routine. Greta holds the worn eyelets on Karloff's skates, one pair at a time, starting at the bottom. When he pulls the laces tight, then he returns the favor on her figure skates. They do this with the patience and kindness of a brother and sister. With skates neatly laced, they step awkwardly through the snow and out to their beloved ice. It's an ordinary cold evening with little wind and many stars. Greta wonders if Karloff ever counts how many times he circles the rink. He never does, but she used to count laps when she swam in swimming pools. She doesn't ask Karloff if he counts, but estimates they do about 50 turns around the rink in an average evening. As usual, they finish at the same time, so tuned to one another, slowing down to the final circle. She knows he was waiting for her to do a spin, but she's not up to it tonight. Karloff's eyebrows and mustache are white with ice particles, and she senses his heart isn't in his skating tonight either. She waits by the snowbank near the ice house for him to finish his last round. That's when she sees them, just beyond the far end of the rink. They hadn't made a sound. As he glides in, she points. Karloff picks up the gun and gestures her into the ice house. She hears one shot as she sits down on the bench of the ice house. Karloff comes inside, and they take off their skates as if nothing had happened. It was a pack, though, a pretty good-sized wolf pack. Later, at Leto's Lodge, the sauna group is sitting in front of the fire, listening to Tom tell his wolf story. When the cuckoo cries, Tom pauses, sitting back while the bird counts off the hours. The others take a good swig of their beer and help themselves to more peanuts. At the closing of the cuckoo clock door, everyone leans forward again, their shadows forming a teepee from the light of the fire. So near the fire, Tom's face is as orange as a rutabaga in a Canadian sunset as he continues his story, having left off in the middle of the river when the cuckoo interrupted at 9 o'clock. "So I'm all alone out there, only one fish in my creel. I've come maybe 100 yards down the river, standing in that wide pond. You know that place, Leto's. There's that little spring there by those big red boulders. So I'm standing there ready to cast. That's when I freeze. I'm just like some statue right there in the middle of the river. They're all looking at me, a dozen at least, standing up on this ridge on the other side of the river. The big one in front is showing his teeth and rolling his black lips real slow so as I can get a good look. Then this big guy starts down the riverbank real slow, and I start backing away just as slow, walking backwards in my waders, hoping I don't trip. I'm reeling in the whole time and do everything real slow and careful. I make it out of the river, get out my knife, it's all I have with me, and I keep walking sort of half forward and half backward to the road, knowing my car's pretty close, yet you can't imagine how far it seemed. Then I just keep walking like that, mostly backward, shaking like a leaf the whole way, my jaw stiffer than a dead moose. I never was so glad to get in a car and out of there in my life, I tell you. Tom finishes his beer in one big gulp, relieved to be away from those wolves again, and next to the nice warm fire. After telling Tom that was some story, everybody sits and looks at the fire, thinking about the wolves, wondering what they would have done. Glad it wasn't them. Tom doesn't tell what Frozy said when he got back that day, how she made fun of his backing down the road with a hunting knife. "You think a little knife is going to protect you from a pack of wolves?" she had said to him in Ukrainian, which somehow made it sound even worse, even dumber. "Yoo-hoo, Greta," Fawn calls out as she nears the dock. "What are you doing out in the cold?" Greta looks at Fawn through a piece of blue glass as she skis toward the dock. "What are you doing out in the cold?" Greta says. Fawn's cheeks and nose are red from the cold, and she takes long, smooth strides up to Greta's dock. "Let me see," Fawn says. She takes the blue glass from Greta's gloved hand. She scans the now transformed horizon of blue and smiles. "Here, try pink," Greta says. Through a chunk of amber, Greta looks at Fawn, viewing their world through rose glass. Fawn snaps off her skis and settles down beside Greta on the dock, and they contemplate the frozen lake, through various colors of glass from the tackle box between them. Inside, over tea, they discuss what everyone on the lake is talking about, wolves and what to do about them. No one can sleep with their howling. Yesterday morning when Greta was at the dock, Tom came over. After he finished chopping wood, madder than hell in his own quiet way, so mad he took out the howling on Greta, lecturing her on how those wolves bit her quick, pretty quick. Rosie cries all night, says it reminds her of Russia, and her pillow is soaked with tears by morning, and it better not go on one more night. Tom walked off, said he was going straight to Karloff's. Thinks it's that shadow of his, says the dog's not normal. Something better be done real quick before everyone goes crazy. Fawn had talked to Millie and Tilly at the grocery store in town yesterday, and they definitely have the jitters. And Tilly said Mabel has such bad constipation over the wolves she didn't get out to the cemetery on Sunday. Seems to me Latos is the one who should do something, instead of just giving Karloff the dog, or Wolf Dog, or whatever he is. He should have done something. I don't know what, but he's the one who trains the huskies and knows about dogs and wolves, Greta says. I just don't understand what they want. They're not hungry. Couldn't be, going by all the deer on the roads at night. Well, I'm used to them, finally, Fawn says. I slept through fine last night. I suppose we're all used to them, hearing them howl from across the lake. It's just that they come so close now. And I don't mind their tracks around the cabin. I would just like to know what they want. I love wolves. Greta moves the icicle plate into the sunlight. Fawn is caught up in her ice fascination and is planning a large shawl for herself in whites with interwoven metallic silver threads. It'll be part of her winter uniform to go with her silver arrow earrings and her white hair. She'll use some of her more unusual wools and furs, including the English sheepdog wool, some good quality sheep wool, and bits of fur she's collected from fences on her ski outings, which include deer and elk and possibly wolf. Greta compliments Fawn on her idea of using several animal yards in one weaving. The blend of prey and predator appeals to them both. They hear a car come down the drive and both get up to see who it is. Freddie Box with the mail. He must have special news to be driving up to the house instead of leaving the mail in the box. He parks and walks hurriedly toward the cabin with long, nervous steps, spitting into the clean snow before he gets to the door. A snuff man, he sucks the remaining spit into the side of his mouth, and his face has a half-sided twitch when he tips his buffalo-checked hat to the women and hands Greta her mail, which includes supply catalogs and a postcard of Isle Royale, in an unfrozen blue lake from Dr. Willie Winkle, which Greta knows Freddie has read and will tell everyone on the lake about within the next half hour. But at the moment, he's just as interested in telling them to watch for Latos and his dog team on the lake. He's going down to talk with some of the Cree folk, Carl Comesofar or Jim Nightman, down by the falls, Freddie tells them breathlessly, about the wolves. He hollers on his way back to the truck. He backs down the drive jerkily. Greta is his last delivery of the day, and they listen as he speeds off down the road in his excitement. The postcard from Thunder Bay says Dr. Winkle will be in Red Otter this weekend and will be staying at Farrelson's Bed and Breakfast. Fawn and Greta look at each other. There is no such place, Fawn says, unless dear old Farrelson is renting out his back room next to the gas station, heaven forbid. Everyone knows that Daryl and his house smell about as clean as a half-dead goat, and Daryl believes he'll die if he takes a bath. He tells anyone who'll listen about his brother, who lived in a small shack out of town, never bathed, and then when they took him to a nursing home 2 years ago, the first thing they did was get him out of his long johns and give him a bath. And, of course, Daryl says he was dead in the morning. But Daryl does leather work and makes hand-tooled belts with exquisite animal and bird designs, which he sells at a stand in front of his house in summer, and from his living room in cold weather. If he weren't so good, no one would go near him. The belts have to be cleaned and aired for a few months before anyone can wear one, but it's worth it, and that's how good he is. Does Dr. Winkle have your phone number? Fawn asks. No, I never put it on my business card. That's the one I left at the co-op with my address. But it's in the phone book. I'll leave my answering machine on this weekend. I'm tempted to go out of town down to Winnipeg for a little shopping, go to the art museum, maybe see a play. But that would be cowardly. Immature, Fawn adds. They both read the postcard again. He wants to take Greta to dinner and a movie. The coffee shop is open until 5 o'clock on Saturday and until 2 o'clock on Sunday. We could have lunch there. Of course there's no movie theater, Greta says. I mean, I'll have to talk to him sometime. People from big cities can't conceive of a town existing and yet not having certain things like a movie theater. I went through that when I moved up here. It took me a while to figure out that the bait shop also rented movies. And I kept driving around looking for a deli and a small theater. Thought I might get involved with that again. We should think about starting a little theater company ourselves. Just start by reading plays. Well, that's something else again. Maybe in the lodge. Good idea, but it won't help this weekend. What if I invite him to the sauna? He'd get the wrong idea. Well, I don't want to miss skating or the sauna. He'll have to entertain himself. I'm not the Red Otter Chamber of Commerce. We don't have one. And here I am feeling guilty, and I didn't even invite him, Greta says, shaking her head. The dogs, Fawn almost shouts. They both rush to the kitchen window. Time to see Latos and his dog team rush by. The dogs, frisky to be out, leap ahead of the sled, pulling Latos down the lake. Running beside the team, unharnessed and easy to recognize because of his long legs and black fur and white face, is Shadow. Shadow's song. My others, needing my others, my furs, fast legs, hurt in shut-up doors, my howling moon, my sad white night, running, running. Meanwhile, in downtown Red Otter, Dr. Winkle pulls up to Don's grocery late Friday afternoon. He spent the last 10 minutes driving up and down Red Otter's 3-block-long Main Street looking for Farrelson's Bed and Breakfast, and has decided that, though he's been told the place is on Main Street, that it's one of those more exclusive and private bed and breakfasts without a sign. You'll find out in the store. Don's grocery appears to be deserted. There's no one at the checkout counter, and he sees no customers, but the store is filled with a strong aroma of freshly cooked bacon. He walks past the produce section, which consists of apples, potatoes, carrots, onions, beets, and 2 surprisingly fresh heads of iceberg lettuce. He walks down the canned good aisle and counts 5 different brands of sauerkraut next to the dog and cat food. Round the corner past the cereal, he comes upon an attractive elderly woman seated in front of the meat counter, eating a plateful of crisply fried bacon. "Can I help you?" she asks Dr. Winkle with a lovely British accent. "Don's out for tea at the moment." "Oh, yes, please. I'm looking for Farrelson's Bed and Breakfast on Main Street. I can't seem to find it." Mrs. Don chokes on her bacon, rushes beyond the meat counter for a drink of water from the sink. Coming back, better, but a bit red in the face, she tells him someone must be pulling his leg, or he has some genuine enemies. There is no Farrelson's Bed and Breakfast, but there is a Daryl Farrelson who lives next to the gas station down at the end of Main Street, who makes leather belts, but he'll find no bed and breakfast there. If Daryl Farrelson had a bed and breakfast, it would have to be called the Pigsty Inn, she tells him. Seriously, that's no place to stay. Daryl Farrelson is the dirtiest man in the province, now that his brother's dead. And she laughs again, but with more control this time. Bacon, she says, offering him the last piece. No thanks, but I'd better go see the man. I did make a reservation. He says, well, suit yourself. There's Leto's Lodge out on the lake. He might open a cabin for you, even though he's closed for the winter. No running water, though. Thanks, most obliged. What did you say your name was? Asked Dr. Winkle. Didn't. Mrs. Don, though. Dora Don. And you are? Dr. Willie Winkle from Thunder Bay. Pleased to meet you, he says, nodding toward Dora. Doctor, are you? I wonder if you might take a look at my bunion while you're in town. She wiggles her right foot and looks at Dr. Winkle hopefully. Sorry, I'm not a medical doctor. Mental, he says, tapping his head and winking as he backs down the aisle away from the meat counter. Say, Mrs. Don, Dora, do you know where I might find some coal? Oh, they've got wood-burning stoves out at Leto's. He'll have wood. No, I just need a small amount, just a few pieces for personal reasons. Well, she says, you could probably pick up a little out next to the railroad tracks. They're on your way to the lake, just past the bridge. You'll have to dig down under the snow, of course. Thanks, he says and waves as he heads past the potatoes and out the door. Daryl Farrelson's bed and breakfast, Dora says, clucking to herself as she washes off the greasy plate. Mental, all right.
You've been listening to Episode 7 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband, Robert Ellis, on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we will hear Prelude No. 8 by Nino Rota.